It's 1:30, so let's call this meeting of the State Government Finance, the Conference Committee for House File 14 to order. Hopefully the Senate will show up at some point. What we are here is this bill was passed from the House and the Senate, and the differences were in it, so we're trying to work out those differences between the House and the Senate bill. But we need to have the Senate here to do that. And I guess I'll start off by calling Secretary Simon to the, and we have a guest here, and Mr. Prates. And as they're coming up, members, just to remind people what we've done so far. We've met before, and the House has made an offer, a couple offers to the Senate, and they've not accepted either of them. And we're kind of waiting for them to give us an offer. Haven't heard back from them. The first offer was to kind of meet halfway between the dollar amounts and go forward from there, and that was turned down. The second one was we offered them the language that they had in their bill and their dollar amount, but a caveat that by the end of session or after the end of session, if nothing is done, it's settled that the Secretary of State will get the remainder of the dollars, and that was voted down by the or not supported by the Senate. And so we are here today. We held the last meeting we held was called by the House, and some the public understands on conference committees every other day the gavel goes back and forth between the House and the Senate. We called the last meeting and the Senate also didn't show up. So we're here today, and Secretary Simon, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks a lot for having me. I really want to thank everyone for being here and for taking seriously Minnesota's critical need for improved election security. Minnesota has long been a leader in election reform and election integrity. Through smart investments and good ideas about democracy, Minnesota has become a model for other states. I'm proud of our system. I'm proud of the thousands of people, ordinary Minnesotans, who make our elections run, whether that's the county auditor or an election judge or a volunteer polling place worker. We have collectively, as one Minnesota, earned the respect of the country. But all of that is at risk. Our role as a leader is at risk because the security of our election system is at risk. Not because we can't protect ourselves, but because some members of the Senate are choosing to leave our system more vulnerable to attack. Today, Minnesota is the only state in America failing to deploy federal resources to the front lines of this new cyber battlefield. Before I proceed, I just have to note for the record how disappointed I am to see that Senator Kiffmeyer and her Senate colleagues are absent again from this important discussion about election security. Make no mistake, the threat of a hack is a big thing. It is a big deal. It is, in my opinion, and in the opinion of election experts around the country, the number one threat to the integrity of our election system. Minnesota was unsuccessfully targeted by a foreign government and by foreign hackers in 2016. And it is today the unanimous view of the federal intelligence community that we must prepare for more attacks and from more sources in 2020. We know that our adversaries will be back, and they will be smarter. If Senator Kiffmeyer and her colleagues were here, they wouldn't have to take my word for that. They could hear from one of our nation's most respected elections experts. I'm grateful to the committee today for working with me to invite Noah Prates here. Until earlier this year, Mr. Prates served as head of elections for Cook County, Illinois. Now, that's significant for at least three reasons. First, Cook County is a huge jurisdiction in a huge state. So Mr. Prates can speak to the complexity and challenges of high-stakes election administration and security. Second, Illinois suffered a serious breach to its election system in 2016 as a result of foreign cyber attack. Mr. Prates knows what worked, what didn't work, and how to recover. These are critical lessons for the future of election security everywhere, including in Minnesota. Finally, Illinois, which already received its share of HAVA funds at the same time that Minnesota did, has begun spending its federal election security money. So Mr. Prates can speak knowledgeably today about why these funds are urgent, why they're critical, and what security investments are making the biggest impact. I can tell you personally, I've come to know Mr. Prates over the last several years as a leader and executive committee member of what's called the Government Coordinating Council, the GCC. I sit on that body. It's organized by U.S. intelligence officials for the purpose of working on security improvements to protect our election system from attack. He currently works on election security issues for the Department of Homeland Security. Mr. Prates is appearing before this committee today on his own behalf. I'm pleased and proud that he would give us some of his time today to share his thoughts and his analysis. But before Mr. Prates gives his testimony, one last words about the efforts of this committee, this conference committee. First, to those senators who are not here again today, you're doing a great disservice to Minnesota. In failing to secure our elections, you are not striking a blow against the House. You are not striking a blow against the Office of Secretary of State or against Democrats. You are striking a blow against the very security of our election system. Finally, I want to thank the members, both Republicans and Democrats, in the Minnesota House for your spirit of collaboration and your spirit of common purpose. This is not a partisan issue anywhere in the country, and it shouldn't be in Minnesota, and it hasn't been in the Minnesota House. And I want to thank Republicans and Democrats for that sincerely. I'm grateful for your willingness to work together in a bipartisan way to meet Minnesota's critical election security needs. Our state and our democracy will be safer for your efforts. Thank you, and with that, I'll hand it over to Mr. Prates for his analysis.
Well, welcome to the committee, and can you state your name for the tape and then proceed with your state, your testimony?
Yes, sir. Thank you. My name is Noah Prates. Thank you, Chair, committee members. Thank you, Secretary Simon. It's a real honor to be here in Minnesota, long a model to us in Illinois and nationwide of effective state and local government, especially with respect to elections. I used to live downriver, in fact, in La Crosse and stayed in La Crescent for a time, and it's good to be home. Today, and most days working in elections, I'm reminded that when election officials certify results, they're an essential part of the process that bestows not simply power, but legitimacy. And that legitimacy comes from the essential American belief that our elections reflect a trusted and true accounting of each election. We secure the legitimacy elections by protecting two virtues, truth and trust. And we do so today along two fronts, an infrastructure front and an information front. Truth can be protected with policies and practices that ensure a fair and accurate count. Trust, though, is protected by continuing to deliver election services as expected by voters and candidates. And you do that by investing in and protecting the technology that we rely upon. So I speak to you today in support of efforts to ensure that legitimacy remains the key virtue in our elections and that we work to support it. Specifically, I speak to you about the necessity to secure our elections infrastructure against all adversaries. A little background on me. Recently, I stepped down as Director of Elections in Cook County, Illinois, where I worked for 19 years. During that time, our office tried to lead on technology and security. We used applied forensics in elections. We created a widely circulated cybersecurity checklist in advance of the 2016 elections, but after the hack of our state website. We published the first white paper written by election officials in the wake of the 2016 attacks. I helped the Center for Internet Security adapt their digital security expertise to the unique context of elections and spent time talking with Harvard's Belfer Center. As co-chair of the Government Coordinating Council, which Secretary Simon's a member of, that the Homeland Security Department created to help address election security, I've been fortunate to work with federal, state, and local leaders in elections, technology, intelligence, and law enforcement. I've had the honor of testifying for the U.S. Senate Rules and Administration Committee, along with Secretary Simon, the House Homeland Security Committee, and the United States Election Assistance Commission. As the Secretary said, I do support the election security initiative inside the Cybersecurity and Election Infrastructure Agency, but today I don't speak on their behalf. I only speak for my time in Cook County. Look, election officials have been securing our nation's votes and voter records for a very long time. They've been securing highly digital networked infrastructure for more than a decade. But the changed environment and the expectation of continued sophisticated attacks forces them to up their game significantly. If the Mueller reports did nothing else, it indisputably underlined the truth we've all come to accept. There are highly capable adversaries who are interested in disrupting the elections institution. And considering that, we all must redouble our efforts to protect elections. Prior to 2000, when I started in the business, election administrators served mostly as logistics managers, kind of like wedding planners, making sure the right list of people came to the right place on the right day. After Bush v. Gore, of course, the Help America Vote Act came to be, and a new era of voting technology was heralded in, and election officials had to become legal compliance and IT managers. They've been working to protect digital technology since. But the 2016 election showed irrefutably that sophisticated attacks are to be expected and that election officials must now become cybersecurity managers. That doesn't mean they need to know all the minutiae of cybersecurity. What it means is they must be aware of the risks and further enabled to allocate resources to manage those risks. Foreign governments, non-state actors, domestic troublemakers each have the capacity and the desire to corrode the essential belief that our election outcomes are true and reliable. To different degrees, this applies both to preliminary results put up on election night and to a lesser degree, official final results. But beyond corrupting election results, the threat reaches the large variety of digital network systems we rely upon to run seamless elections. Things like poll books, election day command centers, mail ballot return systems, informational websites. Therefore, the new security mantra or security framework for election officials should be defend, detect, recover. And though defense is incredibly important and need constant investment, election security isn't simply about defense. Perfect defense is very, very difficult and potentially impossible. I could cite a list of our best companies and government entities that have been breached and damaged despite significant defensive investments. Think about Equifax or Uber, HBO or Sony. This isn't hypothetical. This is real. But instead of just defense, the challenge of election security is to ensure that no attack exceeds our resilience or our ability to detect and recover from attacks, whether that requires restoring lost data or even recounting ballots to establish election results that are trusted and true. Spurred by the need to defend against foreign enemies, federal and state officials have been working successfully to find a good balance of federal involvement in elections without trampling on the authorities states have zealously guarded. Good progress is being made, and hundreds of millions of federal dollars have been invested in nearly all states around the country in recognition of the threat and the need to invest. But more remains to be done nationwide. Even as the community of election officials appreciate that election 2018 was free of any known incidents, they largely recognize those successes are less a function of their efforts, which have been significant, than they are a function of the nation's adversaries' probable choice to hold back. The fundamentals of election security and investments needed to ensure improved security have not changed since the summer of 2016. As election officials, as Americans, we must accept the conclusion of our intelligence community and our law enforcement community that our elections were targeted and are vulnerable. And while enemy hostile probes of our news and influence systems certainly appear to have been more successful in 2016 than those on election administration infrastructure, we expect the attacks will evolve. This is true on the information front and on the infrastructure front. Election administrators must be supported to defend their section of the line, that portion of the infrastructure which they have complete control of. I remember the summer day in 2016 when I started receiving emails from our staff indicating that the Illinois statewide voter database was down. Now, we had a bottom-up system in Illinois, and the impact at the local level wasn't significant. In fact, it wasn't until weeks later that we even learned there'd been a breach to the system, later attributed to foreign adversaries. Little did we know then, though, that we stood at an inflection point in our business. Like Bush, Gore, 2000, the industries and responsibilities have changed forever. Now, I worked for a county and not the state of Illinois, and the breach was of a state system, which is one good reason that a significant amount of the federal HAVA funds are being used in Illinois to shore up the voter database, and in most states. But in 2016, it took weeks for Illinois to recognize they had a vulnerability that was being exploited. It wasn't, in fact, an overly sophisticated attack, and in hindsight, there were probably defenses. But Illinois' election system was targeted, and the bad guys were inside for a while getting data. And Illinois officials believe it wasn't until after the attacks ramped up purposely that they became obvious and they became aware of it. The state took down the system, did investigations with technology professionals and law enforcement, closed the vulnerabilities, notified thousands of impacted voters, and reopened the system that's critical to running confidence-worthy elections in Illinois. At the same time, state and federal security professionals and law enforcement professionals were investigating. And while it's true that almost every online system everywhere is routinely scanned by computers to see if there are weaknesses, like a thief testing doors in an apartment building, it is not the case that foreign adversaries with full units dedicated to the task are looking routinely at every system. These are the adversaries we face, and the ones we failed to adequately defend against in Illinois. I hope no other state or local election official is next, and that's why for 2 years I've been advocating for fast investment of all available resources. Had Illinois been aware at the time of the high probability attack, as election officials everywhere are now aware, they could have acted differently. Of course, they weren't aware then. No election official was. But we all know better now. We all know there are committed adversaries with means and intent who are looking for opportunities to be disruptive to our institution, whether that's through social media and disinformation or the disruption of the various systems relied upon to run elections. We must do what we can to shut down as many of those opportunities as possible by investing in defense. I feel confident that Illinois would have undertaken many of the significant steps your state HAVA working group has recommended taking. They're well within the range of reasonable, in fact, exceptional approaches being taken around the country. Time now is exceedingly more important than working around the edges to achieve agreed notions of perfection. In Illinois, we struggled for a short time debating on the appropriate level of investment and on which projects. Ultimately, however, all agreed that if the federal government invested through the states, failure to invest that money quickly into election obscurity would mean that whoever was responsible for the roadblock would own the future failure. And so debate ensued, it ended quickly, and the state moved forward. While it's true there are a wide variety of behaviors to guard against in elections, each of different consequence and different impact, it is also true that nearly the entire country, and certainly every election official, accepts that our digital systems are vulnerable to advanced persistent threats, and therefore they need investment now. That is why Illinois, like every other state, applied for federal funds aimed at supporting election security efforts, and that is why they put so much of it to use quickly. During debate in Illinois about how to spend the money, I tried to emphasize one message. The federal government is investing $380 million in HAVA funds now to address cyber vulnerabilities, and that money needs to be spent now. That money invested couldn't possibly do everything the states and local election officials need done, and it was possible, maybe even probable, that some of those investments might be in areas that in hindsight prove wrong. But even the imperfect allocation of finite resources today is far superior to holding and squirreling away resources for some event in the future, particularly in the case of known adversaries. That argument ultimately won out and investment flowed quickly in the state. Each actor ultimately recognized that if they held the federal funds and something bad happened on the election security front, the accountable party would be clear. In Illinois, we received $14 million. Our legislature and executive of different parties moved quickly to make those funds available to the state election officials. And that was no small accomplishment in Illinois, where years were spent in gridlocked, and there was a supercharged campaign for the executive. And when it came to the conclusions of the intelligence community, and the universally accepted importance of elections, nothing was going to get in the way of shoring up the infrastructure. I believe there was a great demonstration of professional governance, nonpartisanship, and apolitical leadership on this issue in Illinois. Early on in the state, we formed a group consisting of representatives of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, the Illinois State Police and their cyber team, the Illinois Information Security Office, the leadership of the local election official associations, and the State Board of Elections. That governance group meets regularly to this day. But back then, we all recognized it was important for the state to keep some money to fortify the system that had been breached. Now, we don't want to fight the last battle over again, but we better not lose the last battle all over again. The State Board had to shore up the most direct access point for foreign adversaries. Those specific additional defenses were left to cyber and database experts inside the state, and they followed recommendation from numerous places, including Homeland Security and the Government Coordinating Council. Good guidance and perfect direction is not the critical path issue today. There are a wide variety of plausible and responsible approaches to securing infrastructure. The critical path issue today is the availability of resources and the time necessary to operationalize the recommendations once the resources are flowing. As well as investing in the statewide voter database, Illinois invested in people to support their locals. The Government Coordinating Council issued guidance suggesting cyber navigators. Our legislature mandated that half of the HAVA funds just relief be expended on a cyber navigator program. Our state board partnered with the executive branch through the governor's office to help utilize state information security expertise and resources in fulfilling this mandate. No governance issues arose in building a support apparatus that supports elections in Illinois. These navigators were put to work in Illinois to accomplish three vital goals. First, they worked to institute the election security framework of defend, detect, recover, helping improve defenses within elections offices and supporting efforts to institute auditing and detection techniques and recovery plans. Second, the navigators are helping do the work necessary to secure free support being offered by public and private organizations like the Department of Homeland Security, the State of Illinois, Google, Microsoft, and Cloudflare, and the Elections Information Sharing and Analysis Center. They're also working with the election vendors who provide much of the elections infrastructure and support to local election officials. These vital efforts can be accomplished here as they are nationwide. I suggested to Congress a year ago that the investments needed to be made as soon as possible. I told them then that it would require the states to cut through any red tape that can delay action. After all, the danger is not hypothetical. We're bracing against renewed attacks we've been told to expect. Voters should feel confident that we have resilient election systems in America. Some states better positioned than others, and you guys actually in a very good policy place, with paper ballots and good audits everywhere. But voters should also understand that without continued investment in people and products, the possibility of successful attack increases. One job of an election administrator, maybe the top job, is to conduct elections so that losing candidates accept the fact that they lost fairly. Anything that hinders their ability to do that decreases confidence in the system and undermines their ability to bestow legitimacy, not just victory. Election officials deploy a wide variety of networked, connected digital services. Each of these is a ripe target for our adversaries. A successful attack against any of those services may not change a single vote, but could still damage public confidence. And this is true in a time of great public suspicion. Some losing candidates are already apt to call their defeats into doubt. A new digital breach, no matter how far removed from the vote counting system, could turn sore losers to cynicism, disbelief, potentially revolt. And that's the reaction the adversaries of the United States want. In fact, in the face of direct targeting by advanced persistent threats of a state or local election office, it's very possible that there will be service disruptions, most likely to things like websites. The bottom line is we cannot eliminate every chance of breach, but we can make sure that successful attacks are rare, and we can provide assurances that we are prepared to recover quickly when they happen. Democracy is not perfect. As Churchill says, it's the worst form of government, except for the others. We need to protect it. We will regret it if our democracy is damaged because we looked away at a critical moment. This is what I told the United States Congress and the Illinois legislature, what I submit to you today. Thank you for the opportunity to appear, and I look forward to any questions.
Well, thank you. And Judge, I just want to point out we have four senators who have joined us. They're not on the committee, but thank you for the interest. And if you have some questions, we'll allow you into the questioning also out of courtesy. Mr. Prates.
Yes, sir.
Now, does Illinois, and Minnesota's one of that was told five states that we have to approve federal dollars when we get them. Does Illinois in that one of those five, or is the state able to spend that money, the Secretary of State, and Illinois is able to spend that money without legislative approval?
Sure. Well, there did have to be an allocation in order for money to be expended. So our state did accept the money, and our legislature and governor acted to accept it and push it out to the State Board of Elections.
Thank you. In your opinion, I mean, can you comment on what happened in Illinois and maybe in Cook County? You have more understanding of it, but what happened in Illinois and what could happen here? I mean, what is the worst case scenario that could happen here that could basically blow up our election?
Did we rely on digital services for everything? The more network connected they are, the more available they are to bad guys sitting across the country or across the world who have very low risk. So the most likely environment is a continued, in my opinion, is a continued push on the information front, continuing to use foreign influence inside of the social media, and we've obviously got to be prepared to contextualize that. But election officials do not have a lot of control in that area. Election officials have plenary control over the infrastructure, so the systems we rely upon to run elections. Those, the more public-facing they are, websites, are the more likely attack vectors. But if you were to ask the Iranians how staying off the internet works, I think they would tell you that somehow they were successful, their nuclear system was taken down even though they never touched the internet. So there are capabilities from committed foes to do significant work. Now that's on the extreme of highly unlikely but possible. Those are the type of things you build audits in to ensure that you catch policies that build resiliency so that in the event that a critical software system is offline, you can continue to deliver results that are trusted and true. But the more highly likely systems are those internet-facing websites.
Members' questions. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Prats. Thank you for being here. Myself, along with lots of other people, are concerned about 2020 and what's going to happen. And do you think that Minnesota and other states should expect more aggressive attempts in 2020, sort of first part? And then a second part, do you think that us not having access to these funds might put us at a greater security risk in the 2020 election?
Sure.
Mr. Prates.
So in two parts, the first one is I think the responsible posture of any risk manager, certainly any chief executive of a state in terms of the elections apparatus and local election officials, they have no choice but to expect attacks that are more sophisticated than the ones that were there, given that the information we've gotten, it is simply the expectation that we have to operate under. Holding as we manage risk and think about the different probabilities of different occurrences, your operational risks of just putting on an election, given that expectation, the responsible answer is to invest available resources in systems to make them less likely to be breached. And so nationwide, there is absolutely an increased risk of system failure, or of defensive breaches, of service disruptions without investment. You'll find local and state election officials petitioning their state governments, as well as the federal government and their local government for investments. And that's true here as well.
Representative Dean.
So thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Prats. So when I think about what's happening in Minnesota, And when I think about the work that the Secretary of State's done at putting together the working group and putting forward what are those things that are going to be critical moving forward as far as outlining how that money is used, do you know if that's a requirement of the federal dollars, or have we already gone beyond what the sort of requirements are from the federal government relative to using these funds for our election security?
So in Illinois, we did not engage in that process. To apply for the funds with the Election Assistance Commission, we had to put forward some documentation, expected expenditures. Our state did that, but we did not create a committee to work collaboratively prior to doing that. So I don't believe it's any requirement.
Representative Dean. Mr. Chair, thank you. And this might actually be a question for Secretary Simon. So I've been thinking a lot about what we've been doing or not doing here in the past several weeks on this conference committee. And I'm thinking about a recount we had in our state several years ago, and the resources were used in that recount to take place. We're one of the states that do a paper backup on every vote, and I'm just going to throw something out there if you could even fathom what this might cost the state. So if our total system was taken down after or in the process of people voting and counting the votes, and we had to go to a hand count for every election throughout the state of Minnesota, not just the statewide, but local county, local city elections, what might the cost of something like that be to Minnesota taxpayers?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, that is the mother of all fiscal notes. I don't know. I can't tell you offhand. It would be very costly, not only in money, but in time, in hassle, in human capital. That would be an extraordinary situation for all contests to have that sort of hand count. Looks like Mr. Prates, do you have something to add to that? Okay. I thought, well, you might know. So that would be very difficult. And we just don't want to risk it. Here we are. I just need to put a fine point on it since they have a microphone. It isn't just we were the only state that hasn't, not only are we the only state that doesn't have the money, we're the only state to have not had the money well into last year. So this is, and there's no explanation for it. We just don't yet even have an explanation for why it's taking this long. It shouldn't take this long. It's not a partisan issue, even here in Minnesota, based on the vote and the support in the House by Democrats and Republicans. But we literally don't even have an explanation, not even a cover story, for why the delay. And that's the most disappointing thing.
Senator Rust, you had a question.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon. I have three questions. One, I'm curious about comparing the sophistication of Minnesota's system with that of Illinois', and I wonder how sophisticated, how recent, how new is Illinois' voting equipment. And then secondly, in your testimony, you mentioned in Minnesota there we have a paper trail. We have paper ballots that support the our election system. And could you comment on those two issues to start with? And then, Mr. Chairman, I have one follow-up.
Thank you very much, ma'am, for the question. Unfortunately, without the sort of technical specifications, I haven't done a deep dive into the different platforms that the statewide systems are built on. So I'm unable to offer any valuable sort of response to the first part of the question.
Mr. Chairman, sir,
Senator, mm-hmm. There's a call of the House, so we have to go back upstairs and vote, so we'll take a short recess here.
Okay.
We'll call it back and... Senator Rush, you had...
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Mr. Prates.
Mr. Prates, I really just wanted, with the first questions, just wanted to know, not necessarily a comparison with Minnesota, but is it, in your professional opinion, does Illinois have sophisticated and up-to-date election equipment?
So thank you for bringing that question to me again. I'll note that comparatively, when it comes to the state voter registration list, Illinois is what's called a bottom-up state. Each of our 108 election authorities have their own voter registration database, and they share information up with a statewide system, and the statewide system shares information down. And that's why the breach in 2016 wasn't felt in the same way at the local levels. As I understand it, this state is constructed differently. It's a top-down system where all of the locals, every one of the counties, is relying entirely upon the state technology infrastructure for the voter registration database. So from that respect, it's a much more high-value target than Illinois, and the consequences of a successful breach are more significant, certainly. With respect to voting equipment, I don't know exactly the state of play in Minnesota, but in Illinois, most of the state is relying on technology that was purchased with HAVA funds in the early 2000s. There's paper, and there's paper audit trails, and so you can do audits and reconstruct an election if you had to at a significant price if the software systems were taken down. But they're very difficult to defend. They're relying on software that isn't supported by technology companies anymore. They're relying on hardware where replacement parts aren't easy to get. So, you know, you invest, in my opinion, in defense to decrease the probability of a bad action occurring. At the same time, you build plans for if it does happen. Failures to invest in election equipment, in software that runs statewide voter registration systems, that doesn't guarantee a bad occurrence, but it does increase the likelihood that it happens.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, my third question has two parts. Does Illinois have provisional balloting?
Yes, ma'am.
Was the acquisition of the funds as agreed to, as you indicated, by both parties and your executive, was there any negotiation on what it would take to get that? Because we've heard pretty strong rumors that the HAVA money is worth about $5 million if only the governor and the legislature would agree to provisional balloting. So that's the price.
Okay.
Provisional balloting, you get the HAVA money. In Illinois, was there any kind of negotiation on what one side or the other of your political parties or the governor said had to happen, or the money wouldn't be forthcoming to the Secretary of State's office?
Mr. Prates.
So, to my knowledge, in Illinois, this funding was not used, and the negotiations around it for anything outside of how to secure this cyber infrastructure. So there were no other extraneous, still important, but extraneous matters brought into that negotiation. And I will point out, just in Illinois, we have provisional balloting, but that's because it was a federal requirement of HAVA in 2002. We have subsequently adopted election day registration.
That would be my final question.
So it's my personal opinion that that's a superior insurance instrument than provisional balloting. Since the adoption of election day registration, there's the incidence of provisional balloting has gone down to very small in those places that offer election day registration in precinct. Some of our counties offer election day registration only at the central headquarters, and in those counties there's a little higher incidence of provisional balloting, but that's because it's the primary insurance instrument for a question with respect to a voter's registration.
So Mr. Chairman, I would just point out then, in Illinois' experience, same-day registration, which Minnesota already has, is superior to provisional balloting, and to adopt that would be a step backward to an inferior policy of election integrity.
I don't want to wade into sort of local policy issues too much. I just want to clarify that when I said Superior, I was sort of wearing my hat
Superior,
as an.
You didn't.
Well, I mean, I thought it was a better insurance instrument, but that as an administrator, if you're able to self-cure on election day in precinct and not push work back to the central office that requires significant resource lift and opens up sort of the local politic machinery, I thought wearing my administrative hat that it was Superior. But I certainly don't want to wade into the sure. sort of politics of the state.
And Mr. Prate, what are the items that causes someone with same registration to have to cast a provisional ballot? I mean, what are reasons for that? What reasons would there be for that?
So there are a few different things. For example, if you requested a mail ballot and you didn't bring it with you, and some counties will force you to vote a provisional ballot. Others will ask you to sign an affidavit. There's a little bit of a wiggle room in Illinois law on how to do that. The primary one where provisional balloting serves as an additional insurance instrument is there are a handful of folks who would try to register on election day, but they might not have the appropriate identification to register on election day. And that is the remaining bucket that is tiny, but used statewide.
And Mr. Prates, what percentage of those provisional ballots end up getting counted then in the election? How does somebody have to, say the case where you said somebody doesn't have the right identification, what do they have to do, and do these people come back and actually make sure their ballots are counted and valid?
Sure. So I mean, there are a number of buckets, but if we want to look just at the bucket of what's called, I think colloquially in our county, was a failed election day registration, of their own volition, very few voters come back to cure that. If there is a super close race and campaigns get involved and start to get the list and chase voters down, then that cure rate goes up. But it's low single digits in my recollection.
So someone that says, like myself, who ran in a special election and lost by 410 votes, not that anyone counts, have a big effect on the election.
Well, so the incidence of a failed election day registration probably statewide wasn't even half of that. It's a really tiny number of voters that can't produce the IDs necessary to register in Illinois. And we've got a fairly, I don't know, liberal or progressive sort of registration rules, but it certainly doesn't require a state issued driver's license. So two pieces of documentation, one showing current address is what it takes, and nearly every voter is able to do that.
Do you, Mr. Prates, we have a vouching system in our state. Do you have that in yours for same-day registration?
Not for same-day registration, no.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and, this will be a question in the end for you, Mr. Prates. So Senator Kiffmeyer was recently quoted as saying, people are being hacked all the time. You're being hacked all the time. I am. This is no big deal, unquote. So looking back at 2016 in Illinois, which your experience with the, Russians' attempt at breaking into the system, would you think that was no big deal?
Mr. Prates.
I do think what happened in 2016 and what we expect to happen in the future is a very big deal. With respect to the first part of the comment, I think it's true our entire society is being socialized to recognize that there are these threats out there, that we've all got to take some responsibility in the area to protect our data, to protect our systems. You'll see in airports and billboards along the road suggestions that individuals should protect themselves from cyber criminals. And so with respect to that original frame to that comment, you know, I agree this is happening everywhere. What's different about elections is the threat actors are significantly more powerful. The consequences of success are potentially devastating. And because of that, I think it is a big deal.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just so I'm sort of understanding the extent of this threat, to withhold or to not allocate $6.6 million, which would help our system in the state of Minnesota to be protected, you know, it seems that you would want to do everything you can to protect the system as best you can with the resources that you have access to. So maybe this is more of a statement than a question, but, you know, I mean, I take some personal precautions to try to make sure that my data and things are safe and secure, and I would hope that we would do everything we could at the state to make sure that happens as well. And when I keep thinking about Minnesota being one of the 50 states who's yet to have this money to be put in place to try to help protect our elections, I'm not a computer whiz, would never even think about hacking, but if I would, I would go after the one of 50 versus the other 49. Would that be a good assumption for me to make?
Mr. Prates.
So, in some ways, these are sort of crimes of opportunity. Deploy the least resources sort of possible, scanning various websites and infrastructure, and getting into the easiest one to get into. When we talk to local election officials around the country, we have the same conversation, or I do. A tiny county would say, I don't have a stoplight. Why would the Russians come after me? And we say, in Illinois, I would share that they're not coming after you. They're coming after anybody whose windows are unlocked, and yours happen to be. These are crimes of opportunity. So to the extent you're not locking your windows or your doors or investing in infrastructure improvement, the chances of something bad happen are higher than in places where we are making those investments. And that's just sort of for routine attacks. I think the advanced persistent threat with a direct target on any place is, you know, the probability of success for them and consequences for our side go up significantly.
Representative Carlson, or Senator, excuse me, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just promoted you.
Mr. Chair, I have a few questions for Mr. Prates. I participated in the interim meetings that Secretary of State Simon had to define and clarify what actions he was going to take. And one of them that particularly struck me was that he was concerned about access into the system. And one of those actions is to install multi-factor authentication. And, you know, of course, that has to be trained, and what we have is one system across the state, and if you get in, you're in. And so you're in across the state generally. And I'm wondering, if this isn't a confidential answer, what was the doorway that they got into the system?
Mr. Prates. So in Illinois, you've got the statewide voter registration system. Again, I worked for the county, and so I'm just passing on, I guess, my understanding of sort of public reporting. They also have a copy of it that is online that enables things like online registration or voter lookup. And so the access was to that sort of secondary system, which is, you know, mirrors the primary statewide voter registration database, but it was to the kind of the online tool. So the access was from far away.
So, Mr.
It wasn't through any county node.
So, Mr. Prates, it sounds a lot like when Target Corporation here got hacked. My understanding from the news reports is that somebody got into a vendor of theirs through their system and were able to then get into the Target system and steal a bunch of information.
So through the HVAC?
Yeah. And so, Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so once they were in, are you aware whether they were downloading information or whether they actually tried to change information? What was the nature of their
It's undisputed that they were exfiltrating data and just pulling voter records. And there's disagreement as to what that number is. There are different numbers in the Mueller indictments versus what sort of Illinois' own investigation and finding had ultimately in the tens of thousands of pieces of data that were taken. Illinois was able to identify, I think, clearly somewhere near 10,000 individuals that triggered the notification rules for data breaches. No data was successfully changed, although my recollection is that they were reporting that there were attempts to write new data to the database as opposed to just taking data, although that's a much sort of more difficult thing to do.
Senator Carlson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I got it right that time.
I probably have a couple of other questions, but I have one more that I have written down here. Of your work in Cook County and in Illinois, what's the current status of that work, and what's the schedule, and is it complete or is it partially complete? What's the current situation to getting these actions taken? And by the way, I do see that you have twice as much money as Minnesota does.
Yeah, no, that's true. And
Mr. Prates.
There are some costs that are sort of fixed regardless of the state. So think about a statewide voter registration database. That may cost, $1 to $2 million to repair, and that's true no matter the size of the state. Leaving, once you deduct that, the available funds to put into other infrastructure is less. Illinois got probably twice as much, 13.8 or so. Now, as I understand it, our State Board of Elections, responsible for the statewide voter registration database, obviously corrected all the vulnerabilities that they knew about. They do work with the Department of Homeland Security and with the state infrastructure and information technology services to do continuous scanning of the websites, looking for new vulnerabilities and getting notified of those. But as you may imagine, the elections field changes so fast. We joined a group called ERIC, and all of a sudden we're trading data with now I think 25 or other states. New laws come online, and they say people can automatically register to vote when they go to the Department of Natural Resources, get a gun license, or when they're applying for unemployment benefits. And we tie in all these new systems to our statewide voter registration database. These are great service offerings. It's what we expect today, but it also, as our voters expect, but it also increases costs. It increases risk points. This is why I think the language of a lot of colleagues were using was the $380 million was important, but it may sort of be a down payment in order to get to the heart of all these problems and get you where you want to be and make it sustainable. We need to be looking at whole of government investment, local, state, federal, at rates significantly higher than the $380 million that was given.
Unfortunately, again, there's another call to the House. As you know, the legislature's in session right now, and I don't know if they're just having fun with us, but maybe they think I need more exercise running up and down. So we're in recess. We'll get this called back to order I understand that our testifier has to leave by 3:30 to catch a flight, so we'll go to 3:30 with questions for him, and I understand Secretary Simon had a family emergency and had to get called away, so that's why he's no longer here. So, members, where were we at? Representative Senator Carlson, were you done with your questioning, or do you have
Never.
He's a senator. That's right, he's a senator.
I do have
Senator Carlson.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'll direct this to Julie, or Ms. Strother, sorry. We have the flag system in our voter files that prompts using the, using the ability to certify at the polls. And we certify at the polls because we do have same-day registration, and the action is the same as same-day registration. Who has access to the voter file to maintain those flags? Now, I think there's like at least four flags, questionable citizenship, questionable residency, whether they're able to vote after a felony conviction, and competence, you know, if you're under guardianship. Who puts that information in, and is that a larger group of people?
Ms. Struthers.
Mr. Chair and Senator, so there are actually more flags. There's additional flags for, like, if a postal verification card is returned, we would flag for checking the address. There's some additional flags. Voter statuses are only changed at the county level, so we house the data at the state level, but it's at the county level, and it's only county officials who are allowed to update a voter's registration. They're the keepers of voter registration statuses, even though we're the keeper of the system. We get that data that is used for the flags, pass it down to the counties, but they're the ones who actually add those flags to the data. Does that make sense?
Senator Carlson.
Okay. Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And now the question, similar question to Mr. Preetz, and that is that, for instance, well, do you have flags like that? And I guess, you know, we discussed voting after incarceration. And maybe you can describe any flags that you have like that. And I guess I'm specifically interested in the incarceration issue, where in Minnesota you can't vote if you're a felon and you're out either on probation or parole.
Sure.
Mr. Preetz.
Well, so that is not a flag that we have because our rule is a custody rule. So if once you're released from physical custody as a felon, your voting rights are restored, so they'd have to re-register. But there are other flags, voters where we've got a concern about residency and they fall into an inactive status. They've got a different identification requirement at the polls. I think I alluded to earlier the idea that if you request a mail ballot but you don't bring it with you to the polls, there's a flag requiring either an affidavit or down the provisional path as each county displays it. Much like Minnesota, the impetus is on the county election officials. All the rights and responsibilities with respect to these statuses are maintained at the local level.
Senator Carlson.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question is, do you purge voters from your voter file? In Minnesota, we purge if you don't vote in two successive presidential elections.
Purge is a tough word because it's fairly loaded, but there is a process for removing voters from the rolls that line up with the National Voter Registration Act of 1992. It requires us to send mailings, move folks from one status to another. Then ultimately, upon meeting all those legal requirements, we can remove them from the rolls. Luckily, since the institution of Election Day registration in Illinois, the downside risk of doing something improperly for any given voter is greatly diminished because we've got the insurance instrument of Election Day registration to correct the mistake that's done at the local level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lane.
It's okay.
Any other questions of this testifier? Well, thank you, Mr. Pratts. Thank you for coming, and thank you for sharing with us what happened in Illinois and a different perspective from another state.
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having me. It was an honor to be before you all.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to testify? Mr. Heller. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson and committee on this HAVA. My name is Rick Heller, and officially represent the Twice Exceptional in House File 1370. It was Senate File 2566 on line 118, or in Education Statute 120B15. I provided a handout for your administrator about the current documents that not online. It's the one from the last testifier from out of state. Hopefully you'll get that posted online. It does sound like they provided to you in a timely manner. This also likely relates to your, the next item I'm gonna talk on is the side-by-side. And it has to do with your current bill called 1962. The headers do not read out loud on the side-by-side. Hopefully, as we move ahead on accessibility for the Minnesota legislature, to provide more civic engagement with the printed word. And perhaps you may entertain it on the floor to provide a, for the working group, which is really a closed meeting group, closed meeting law group, that provide a porthole for the public to provide input other than the four employees or staff in the House and Senate. So basically that's in a nutshell. I've already expressed before, if you go to lines 113 in the joint bills, and then lines 114. Lines 113 is improving accessibility. It's my understanding that, correct me if I'm wrong, the Secretary of State's here, their staff, that they can only use this specifically for HAVA. Currently, the Secretary of State is a constitution office. They don't have to apply the accessibility law, and consider that for a bill next year on this. But right now, that'll help to improve the accessibility of people wanting to vote and getting access to that information. The second one I spoke on back in March with those Heller handouts had to do with the training materials. That's on line 114 again. And the judges aren't required to pronounce those words. It's a local decision when the machines that read out loud don't read out loud. Maybe I'm splitting hairs, but I don't know how many spoiled ballots are out there that people can't spell the words correctly in the write-ins, especially English as a second language. Obviously, it's probably at discretion of the locals to decide. And now with us deciding one of the four parties that we're going to be voting to help figure out what name is on that ballot. So those are the things I have to add to this process. And again, I look forward to working with you, Mr. Nelson, on that bill, 1962, on providing that. And thank you again for this opportunity to speak. I'm open to any questions if anyone's interested in that.
Any questions for the testifier? I see none. Thank you, Mr. Heller. And the document that you talked about that was given, that we just got this morning. And
I understand. That one thing about this process about accessibility is one thing, but timely helps your piece out, and hopefully the bill will capture that. Because it doesn't express the word timely, but the functionality piece for the public to provide more feedback in the next 2 years or a year on this would be important to add a few pieces, not just a closed meeting for the employees here, because I do understand that the legislature wants to be an equal opportunity employer. And you want to get that house in order before you approach the public. Thank you again for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Anybody else that would like to testify before the committee? Well, seeing none, and seeing that we have our compatriots on the conference committee from the Senate have not showed up, any further discussion? Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, and I know there's been trouble having everybody get together on these meetings. I do think now when both houses or both chambers are running, I do think or did hear that the state government finance bill might be up right now over in the Senate, the other body, which may have precluded some attendance today. So I don't know how we do this, but just, you know, so that people are aware that this time there may, because of all of these conflicting things, that it will be difficult possibly to get people together. And I applaud you on your efforts. Thank you.
Well, Representative Vogel, we put the notice out and we asked them, and if they had gotten back to us, they would have better time. But they didn't get back to us at all. This notice has been out for over 2 weeks. And so, I mean, and previous to that, the last meeting we held, that they did not show up at all. So, like I said at the beginning of the meeting, the way the rules for conference committees go is the gavel goes back and forth every other day. Senator Kiffmeyer could have called a meeting on a Monday, Wednesday, or a Friday and has not done that and has not communicated with us about what she wants or even come forward with a offer to us. So it's a matter of, this is the first opportunity. This gentleman said he could come up and speak to us, and the day was the day he could do that, so we set the meeting up to do this, notified the Senate. They haven't showed up. So it's like us, we're on the floor also, and as we've had to leave a couple of times because of the call of the House, we've got, this happens a lot with this time of session when we have conference committees, is they'll be meeting while we're in long sessions and have to go back and forth. So there could have been a way for them to get here. So.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I applaud your efforts on trying to put it together.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. And members, with that, if there's seeing no other business before this committee, Representative Dean.
Well, thank you, Chair Nelson. And, you know, this conference committee has been open for a long, long time. There have already been several bills that have gone through the House. Conference committees have met. They have resolved the differences, and we've been able to pass them and move them on to the governor for signature. And I hope that this doesn't portend to what the future is going to be for a conference committee when we have difficult things to deal with. You know, the Senate and the House are very far apart on some of our bills. And if the way in which we are going to address that is just by not wanting to negotiate, you know, I think it would be foolish to think that we'll have our work done by May 20th. But I would just hope that, you know, at some point conversations would take place with the Senate that we can actually resolve this conference committee prior to taking up the state government finance bill, which we're going to be taking up, which I know this is in there and part of it, because this should have been the easy lift and the easy thing for us. And for some reason, this has become one of the most difficult things that we've had to deal with so far this session. So I just hope that this isn't an indication of what the future lies when we realize that the Senate and the House may be far apart on issues, whether it's transportation, whether it's issues of public safety, or many of the other bills that we're going to be bringing forward. Because if it is, I'd say cancel your summer plans, folks. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean, I hope that's not the case. I hope we can get our work done. But I do, too, am a little frustrated and going forward on this. And this would be nice if we could have got this, if we could get this part of the state government finance bill out of the way. We could take it out of it, make it a little less controversial. But there should be no controversy to this. It's a shame that this is being held up at what it appears to be as a bargaining chip for the end of session and or a bargaining chip for other things. This is, too, I think, too important, our election security, to have it be held up for a bargaining chip on something else. So with that, members, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to say that I don't know that we've had something that has been such a small amount of money with so much controversy in it. But this is an extremely important issue. I think we've heard it from our testifiers, and we've heard it in the papers. I have here page 50 of the Mueller report, and I'm going to read a bit of it here just to make sure that I'm quickly doing this, but by at least the summer of 2016, GRU officers, now GRU is the Russian intelligence, sought to access state and local computer networks by exploiting known software vulnerabilities on websites of state and local government entities. GRU officers, for example, targeted state and local databases of registered voters using a technique known as SQL injection, by which malicious code was sent to the state or local website in order to run commands. And I'll leave the rest of it. Anybody can read it, page 50. This is something that's really critical. It's something that we should be doing. And I'm going to say that there was enough Senate members to do a vote. Four of us came here. We're in the same committee, and I'm interested in that very same bill. But we came here because this is very important, and it is not something that we need to just kick aside and wait until later. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lane.
Senator
Lane.
I'm just feeling that the clarity around provisional balloting could use a few more words, that provisional balloting in other states in the past was created for the purpose of letting people vote who couldn't register ahead of time, like 30 days ahead of time, so it allowed them to vote same day. And when you have same-day registration, you don't need provisional balloting then. As we have in Minnesota, we have a same-day voting, and we actually have the verification that you can vote requires a visual ID and a verification of your address, so it's more stringent. And so there's no need for any provisional balloting in Minnesota. The very partisan so-called provisional balloting that is being offered by the other side here, as almost a, if you give me that, I'll give you this kind of thing, is a different sort of thing, and it would be used with her same-day registration as a way to call out people and not let them vote, except, quote, provisionally. So its attention is not to support our American right to vote, but to actually attack it. It's a totally different kind of, quote, provisional balloting, and it just cannot be. And I have heard the governor say, I am not giving anything for HAVA funds. We just need the HAVA funds.
Thank you. With members, with that, we're adjourned.